1940, September 17th. The House of Commons, London. Secret session.
A few days ago, I had a notification from the chiefs of the staff. They considered that the date and time of this meeting of ours today had been so widely advertised that to hold it would be to incur an undue risk, and that it should be put off to some date and hour which had not been publicly announced. I felt, however, that members would be offended if any course was taken which suggested for a moment that we should shirk our duty out of considerations of personal safety. And then there is all that argument which occurs to everyone about setting an example and of the incongruity of our ordering government departments and urging factory workers to remain at work while we ourselves did not assemble on particular occasions as we had resolved to do. Nevertheless, this is a matter on which there should be clear thinking. We should fail in our duty if we went to the other extreme, and in a spirit of mettlesome bravado made it unduly easy for the enemy to inflict loss and inconvenience upon the public service. We ought not to flatter ourselves by imagining that we are irreplaceable, but at the same time it cannot be denied that 200 or 300 by-elections would be a quite needless complication of our affairs at this particular juncture. Moreover, I suppose that if Hitler made a clean sweep of the Houses of Parliament, it would give widespread and unwholesome satisfaction throughout Germany and be vaunted as another triumph for the Nazi system of government. We must exercise reasonable prudence and a certain amount of guile in combating the malice of the enemy. It is no part of good sense to proclaim the hour and the dates of our meetings long beforehand. Here we are sitting on the target. This group of well-known, prominent buildings and towers between three major railway stations, with the river as a perfect guide by night and day, is the easiest of all targets, and I have very little doubt that they will need extensive repairs before very long. We have seen how unscrupulous and spiteful the enemy is by his daylight attacks on Buckingham Palace, and anyone has only to walk to Smith Square or St. Thomas's Hospital to see the kind of damage that a single aeroplane can do. We have not got to think only of ourselves in considering the matter. There is a large number of officials and staff attached to the House who have to be in attendance upon us when we are sitting. There is no guarantee that the warning will be given in time. Even our watcher up aloft would very likely give his signal only at the moment when the bombs were already released. The firing of the artillery is no useful warning because it fires so often, and we should be hindered in our business if we attended to that. Therefore, I am going to propose to the House three measures which they will find fully consonant with their dignity and with their duty. And with your permission, Mr. Speaker, I now propose to outline their character. The first is that the hours and dates of our sitting shall not be made public in the press or announced beforehand, and that they shall be left in uncertainty. Therefore, I propose to move that when we adjourn today, it will be to an hour and a date which will, as far as possible, be kept secret. But the second measure which I propose is that we should alter the hour of our sittings. We must expect that at any time after dark, the nightly air raiding will begin. Our barrage will be firing, and apart from bombs, great numbers of shell splinters, usually described most erroneously as shrapnel, will be falling in the streets. It is better for members and the officials and staff of the House to be in their homes or in their shelters before this begins. I shall therefore propose that we meet at 11 in the morning and conclude our business at 4 in the afternoon, with half an hour for the debate on the adjournment. This brings me to my third proposal. The fact that we meet in the mornings will be a great convenience to members, but it only throws a heavier burden on ministers and the public departments. Not only cabinets, but many scores of important meetings take place every morning, and the whole work of the staffs and the departments in the afternoon is affected by their decisions. If any large number of ministers have to be in attendance upon the House, the whole progress of war administration will be delayed or even deranged. Take the case of the Minister of Health, who is tomorrow to be in charge of a debate upon the general health of the nation. This is a most interesting and important topic, but the Minister of Health is already working to the utmost limit of its strength on the many difficult situations created by the bombing of London, by its effects on drainage, which is a serious problem, some of our great sewers having been broken, upon the rehousing of persons rendered homeless through their dwellings being destroyed or damaged, or because they have to be evacuated from districts on account of unexploded bombs or other special causes. He has also to deal with the danger to national health arising out of people being crowded together in shelters and contracting diseases, which under these conditions, unless they are vigorously coped with, may foster epidemics of diphtheria, typhoid, and influenza. In fact, he is fighting the danger of pestilence. Now, I am first of all a parliamentarian and House of Commons man. If I have any say in matters at the present time, it is due mainly to this House, and I therefore set parliamentary duties above everything, subject, of course, to the leave of the House, which I am sure would be generously given. Now, right honourable friend will therefore carry out the programme as it has been arranged, if the House so desires. But I must appeal to the House to show its consideration for ministers and for a government in whom it has recorded its confidence almost unanimously. We are really doing our very best. There are no doubt many mistakes and shortcomings. A lot of things are done none too well. Some things that ought to be done have not yet been done. Some things have been done that had better have been left undone. But looking broadly at the whole picture, as it is viewed by any impartial eye, the way in which our system of government and society is standing up to its present ordeals, which will certainly increase in severity, constitutes a magnificent achievement and has justly commanded the wonder and admiration of every friendly nation in the world. I ask therefore for the indulgence of the House and for its support in not requiring too many sittings in the next month or two. Of course, if anything happens which raises any novel or fundamental issue for which the authority of Parliament is required, we shall immediately summon Parliament, even if it were only a few days after we have separated. And we shall make it our business to keep in touch with all parties and groups, not only through what are called the usual channels, but through any other channels which may be open. These next few weeks are grave and anxious. I said just now in the public session that the deployment of the enemy's invasion preparations and the assembly of his ships and barges is steadily proceeding, and that at any moment a major assault may be launched upon this island. I now say in secret that upwards of 1,700 self-propelled barges and more than 200 sea-going ships, some very large ships, are already gathered at the many invasion ports in German occupation. If this is all a pretense and stratagem to pin us down here, it has been executed with surprising thoroughness and on a gigantic scale. Some of these ships and barges, when struck by our bombing counterattack and preventive attack, have blown up with tremendous explosions, showing that they are fully loaded with all the munitions needed for the invading armies and to beat us down and subjugate us utterly. The shipping available and now assembled is sufficient to carry in one voyage nearly 500,000 men. We should, of course, expect to drown a great many on the way over and to destroy a large proportion of their vessels. But when you reflect upon the many points from which they could start, and upon the fact that even the most likely sector of invasion, that is to say, the sector in which enemy fighter support is available for their bombers and dive bombers, extending from the Wash to the Isle of Wight, is nearly as long as the whole front in France, from the Alps to the sea, and also from the dangers of fog or artificial fog, one must expect many lodgments, or attempted lodgments, to be made on our island simultaneously. The difficulties of the invader are not ended when he sets foot on shore. A new chapter of perils opens upon him. I am confident we shall succeed in defeating and largely destroying this most tremendous onslaught by which we are now threatened. And anyhow, whatever happens, we will all go down fighting to the end. I feel as sure as the sun will rise tomorrow that we shall be victorious. But I ask the House to assist us in solving these problems, worse than any that have ever threatened the civilized community before, by meeting the wishes of the government in the arrangement of parliamentary business and in lightening the burden which rests upon the men in charge.
Desert Victory, From the Second World War, Chapter 31.
We may, I am sure, rate this tremendous year as the most splendid, as it was the most deadly year in our long English and British story. It was a great, quaintly organized England that had destroyed the Spanish Armada. A strong flame of conviction and resolve carried us through the 25 years conflict which William II and Marlborough waged against Louis XIV. There was a famous period with Chatham. There was a long struggle against Napoleon, in which our survival was secured through the domination of the seas by the British Navy under the classic leadership of Nelson and his associates. A million Britons died in the First World War, but nothing surpasses 1940. By the end of that year, this small and ancient island, with its devoted commonwealth, dominions, and attachments under every sky, had proved itself capable of bearing the whole impact and weight of world destiny. All our latent strength was now alive. The air terror had been measured. The island was intangible, inviolate. Henceforward, we too would have weapons with which to fight. Henceforward, we too would be a highly organized war machine. We had shown the world that we could hold our own. There were two sides to the question of Hitler's world domination. Britain, whom so many had counted out, was still in the ring, far stronger than she had ever been, and gathering strength with every day. Time had once again come over to our side, and not only to our national side. The United States was arming fast and drawing ever nearer to the conflict. Soviet Russia, who with callous miscalculation had adjudged us worthless at the outbreak of the war, and had bought from Germany fleeting immunity and a share of the booty, had also become much stronger and had secured advanced positions for our own defense. Japan seemed for the moment to be overawed by the evident prospect of a prolonged world war, and anxiously watching Russia and the United States, meditated profoundly what it would be wise and profitable to do. And now this Britain and its far-spread association of states and dependencies, which had seemed on the verge of ruin, whose very heart was about to be pierced, had been for 15 months concentrated upon the war problem, training its men, and devoting all its infinitely varied vitalities to the struggle. With a gasp of astonishment and relief, the smaller neutrals and the subjugated states saw that the stars still shone in the sky. Hope, and within it passion, burned anew in the hearts of hundreds of millions of men. The good cause would triumph. Life would not be trampled down. The flag of freedom, which in this fateful hour was the Union Jack, would still fly in all the winds that blew. But I and my faithful colleagues, who brooded with accurate information at the summit of the scene, had no lack of cares. The shadow of the U-boat blockade already cast its chill upon us. All our plans depended upon the defeat of this menace. The Battle of France was lost. The Battle of Britain was won. The Battle of the Atlantic had now to be fought.